Good evening and welcome to A Game at a Time. The sentiment around our episode this evening is that the game becomes an open style style of game where, in fact, you are excited now to go along and see this game. It draws crowds and it becomes emblematic of Melbourne, the colony. And Melbourne, by this time, is a rich and wonderful place to be. And it's a place that, in fact, attracts those who are part of the wider Australian colony already. And those coming from Europe, in fact, arrive knowing that it is sort of a fancier city than has existed in Australia ever before. And there's a lot of money and a lot of development. And along with all of that, the expansion of the game itself is what ensues. It's a very good evening to Finn O'Sullivan.
A very good evening to you, gentlemen. I'm looking forward to this, in this episode, is the way that the rules were, pushed and pulled by simply someone's skill. So directly related, a rule being changed because of a player's exceptional ability at something, and I am certainly going to focus on Henry Harrison's ability to run the 50 seconds over 440 yards. And a good evening to you, Ryan Miller.
Oh, evening, Finny. Evening, gents. That is quite fast.
That's just about the time that Kathy Freeman ran for her gold medal.
The same. Yep.
So she was a 49-second gold medal winner in the 2000 Olympics, and Henry Harrison is running almost that time over that yardage, 150 years previous.
That's funny you mentioned Kathy Freeman, because number 29 for Melbourne, Hunt, at this day, he beat Kathy Freeman over 20 metres at the Melbourne Science Works 1 week ago.
Yeah, Jaden Hunt.
Yeah, Hunt. Yeah. Beat her over.
He's got lovely hair, Jaden Hunt. I noticed on the weekend. Lovely hair.
It's more about the headband, isn't it, really?
Well, it's necessary with that lovely hair, I think.
Okay, so this evening is really about something so simple as, can you pick the ball up and run with it or not? This is the bone of contention that exists, because the presumption really by I suppose about 1860 is you're allowed to have the ball in hand, but only for as long as it takes to kick it. You can't run along with it and gain 5 or 6 yards. Really, you take a step or two until you could be said to be steady, and then kick the ball. So about what is expected of a box kick in rugby union now. You're allowed to get the ball and be, you know, you don't have to just like snap it in a way that would never gain any yards. As long as your off leg can be said to be grounded, then you can be ready to kick. This, of course, causes no end of dispute. And the real disaster for the game is that it's different depending on who you're playing against. So in this form of sort of, I feel like games that are played in this early 1860s sort of time, or even late 1850s, is a bit of a pub rule sort of game where the captains decide on how it's going to be. Maybe even they decided on how many steps it was going to be. And that's how they officiated the game. You know, when you go to a pub and they've got some weird, you know, you can shoot backwards or whatever sort of rule. I feel like that's how
talking
it was.
Pool, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, exactly. And it appears to be that the rule for most people was the ball shall not be run with.
Yeah.
At all.
And also as well, like, it's an 800, you know, we've got to remember we're playing on this 800 metre park at, you know, Yarra Park. The, you know, scrum mentality still for the most part. Ball comes to the back. Guy at the back hoists it. And he has to kick it sort of side on. And this idea of a box kick, like you said, Liam, like, it has to go that way, because if he turns, he's going to get hit by someone from the opposition. Mm. He's got to hoist it up. someone catches it, you get another scrum, it moves on, hoist it, another scrum. 800 meter field, it's a fairly slow sort of affair at this point, and there's some restrictions there. So yeah, look, there's no running at this point and they're restricting it, but it's an 800 meter park. In my head, it's only a matter of time before someone sort of gets a bit of a moment where they go, yeah, I'm going to go with this one. I'm going to pick it up and go. So yeah, I think the scale of the field still needs to be kept in everyone's head here. It's a massive park.
Absolutely. And I think we also need to know that the running of the game was occurring, 100K south, at Geelong, during 1860. And they're doing a bit of reading. Wills did move down there. He gave up on his career as a lawyer and wanted to, and just went down there, to do a bit of blacksmith work. And he's certainly credited with at least being around at the time of the Geelong Footy Club. And I think it's quite safe to assume that his influence of this rugby style would have influenced the men that were making the rules down there at the time in 1859 into 1860 to play more a running game, because of course they were able to run with the ball down there. And I think that would have been exacerbated by Henry Harrison moving down there. He got a gig with the customs department at that very time. So suddenly you've got Wills down there, a rugby schoolboy. You've got Henry Harrison, the fastest man in the colony, moving down there. It's no coincidence that their game became a running type of game.
If you take the cheekiness of Wills placing those players beyond the offside or the presumed offside line, that would be feared tactically, but Harrison, it seems, is scary for a whole different reason. That he effectively has the same sort of strategic clout that Wills has, but he's quite tall, so he's almost he's 5'11" in the old. He's 77 kilos and incredibly quick. And some poor bastard who he ran into by the name of Marshall admitted to coming off second best by saying, "Harrison tucked the ball under his arm and set his teeth. This always meant mischief. Nothing loath, I charged straight for him. Crash. I thought every bone in my body was broken." Now you can imagine that a guy doing something like this would have said to people, yeah, like the sentiment behind everyone else's view would have been, you know, you can't run with the ball. If people are going to be running over there with the ball, no, you can't run with the ball. You're going to have to kick it right away. Because the fast and strong all of a sudden become like the big forwards at pace in rugby union, or anyone in rugby league, really. And that's frightening for your average run of the mill.
It's a massive change to what they've been used to. You know, they're not built for that kind of, well, they haven't been taught that or developed the skills to either deal with that kind of contact. You know, it's a totally different skill. I don't think this would have been allowed unless he had Wills in his pocket as well. You can't underestimate the power.
They're cousins, yeah, as well.
Yeah. The strength that this guy, the influence that this guy has, without Wills being down in Geelong when Harrison was down there. You would argue that these rule changes wouldn't have been allowed. If Wills didn't know him and he was on the opposition, Wills has got a hell of a lot of clout. He was in that original seven blokes in the pub. You sort of argue that probably, who knows where the game would have developed or how it would have changed. Yeah?
You got to think that there was many more meetings at the Parade Hotel with undocumented rules. You know, you can imagine these blokes. You just imagine meeting with your cousin to manipulate something in your own family.
Yeah.
These guys are meeting to go, you know what, that bloody rule 10, I don't like the look of it. Let's make a change.
Which happened. I mean, rule 8, again, the ball may be taken in hand only when caught from foot. Within weeks, that was changed at any time to be taken by hand but not carried further necessary to kick, as Liam said. But a year later, and I don't think we touched on this, is that it got drastically changed to it may not be lifted from the ground under any circumstances or taken by hand. So basically the only time that you were, and going back to the Sheffield and Cambridge side of things was for a fair mark or a fair catch, as they would call it. So in 1860, as the rules were written, you can imagine a game that was closer to association football or rugby, association football or soccer, I should say, than it was to the running game that we're discussing right now. So instead of it being pushed to kind of a soccer rugby mold, moving towards the rugby style, it actually moved towards soccer a little bit more at the beginning and then did a full circle when Wills did his coup de main, and then finally when we're talking about Harrison running with the ball. So it wasn't as simple as going, we've got a homogenization of both and it goes into rugby. It didn't do that.
Yeah.
And let's talk about, as we enter into the 1860s, even though in 1859 a set of rules has moved down to Geelong, they've began to play down there, clubs start to emerge over the 1860s. So we talk about Melbourne University, South Yarra, Albert Park.
Essendon had one in 1862.
Yeah, and then you find that Carlton emerges. Now, geographically speaking, if you consider that the very edge of Royal Park is the absolute outskirts of Melbourne, we're talking the beginnings of Sydney Road are truly the slums. On the eastern side of Melbourne, we're talking Punt Road, the beginnings of what becomes Victoria Street rather than Victoria Parade as soon as you move over there. Those are slums, and then as soon as you get to what is Brunswick Street and so on in the northern part of Melbourne, you wind up with it being slums there. So we're really talking about a colonial settlement that is very small, but it's becoming sophisticated in the sense that, you know, you've got suburbs like Carlton that are legitimately organised with infrastructure enough to warrant a real football club.
Yeah, and I think interestingly as well, that like in line with this level of formalised structure around number of players playing, how it's going to be officiated, the time of the actual activity, in line with this idea that Melbourne is incredibly vibrant and relatively wealthy as well.
And an attractive place to come.
Well, exactly right. And these are the people who were coming at that time weren't, you know, this idea behind convicts isn't necessarily the whole story. It's people from relatively wealthy backgrounds who want to make good and have this clean slate, not just from a sporting background, but in terms of their, ability to make money. If they've been exposed to all these different things and then you've got this new sporting environment, I think, again, it allows people to be innovative and come up with ways that the game is going to develop in a really unique way, which is exactly what happened, Finney, I guess.
Absolutely. And look, I think moving on the concept of a rule changing because of one person.
And that's Harrison.
And that is Harrison. And I guess down in 1862, a Melbourne v Geelong game, where Melbourne actually went down to Geelong.
Harrison's gone down to Geelong for work.
Yep.
He works for the customs department.
Yep.
And he's shifted down there.
Yep.
And he brings his view about play to them.
But remember, yeah, Wills was there before Harrison. So Wills did go down to Geelong.
Mm-hmm.
Because he did decide that, that father wanted him to be a lawyer. It wasn't working for him, and his family had a property close to where Geelong was known to begin, near the Argyle Oval. And so I guess having Wills and Harrison down there at the same time certainly made that running rule that they do, or that they had, you know, quite prominent.
Is that correct, though? Wills left Victoria in 1861 to move to Queensland.
And
whilst in Queensland, he deals with the catastrophe of
Yeah, so he leaves Victoria, not he doesn't leave Melbourne. Yep.
Yeah, okay.
He comes back in 1864.
Okay.
And so he is down at Geelong at that time.
Right.
And
so Harrison spends time down there by himself without Wills, creating a style of game and participating in it.
For a few years he's down there, and a dispute breaks out during this Melbourne Geelong game in 1862.
That's how it should be. There should be disputes at
games. And again, the captain of Geelong, which he is, he flouts this rule at the time, may not be lifted from the ground under any circumstances, all taken by hand. So it's not the original rule where it shall not be lifted from the ground. And then it's not that adjusting of the rule where you can take it but only run just a little bit to steady yourself to kick. The rule in 1860 was it may not be lifted from the ground under any circumstances or taken by hand. So he's completely ignoring these Melbourne rules as they were. And Melbourne walked off, refused to play this style, this brand of style. So it wasn't even, as you were discussing, Mill, in the previous podcast, where you'd play one set of rules in one half and the other. No, Melbourne were...
big sooks.
Big sooks. Mm. And the funny thing is that he returned to Melbourne the following year to play for them. And suddenly they were okay with him carrying it 40 yards or 50 yards at a time without... without bouncing or any sort of limitation.
Yeah, so in Bell's life, someone's written in to say all players are aware that the Melbourne rules are a farce and are only put into force when the club finds a likelihood of an opposing team kicking a goal, and then they cry, free kick, he's broken the rules. As if, you know, somehow the Melbourne guys are cheats. And I suppose I'm happy with that, really, you know. A bunch of privileged so-and-sos.
So-and-sos.
I've got to say.
He's really found his manners in this episode compared to... Right.
He's really good.
If you have heard episode two, really well. Liam wasn't quite so polite.
That Harrison, in fact, forces Melbourne to come to terms with their inability to follow a set of rules that they've endorsed. Because he comes back and plays in 1863, and as soon as they play against that first form of the Richmond Footy Club, there is this sense that there can be a shared game that's different, that people can get along with, and that this idea of running with the ball is effectively challenged not too long after that, where... the best runner in the colony is in fact encouraged to challenge the running rule. And have you got that thing?
Yeah, I guess it also comes from when he comes back to Melbourne. Remember, Melbourne was the first club. So, you know, if the captain of Melbourne can do it, the other teams are surely thinking, well, why can't we?
A simple endorsement, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if this is the first club, then you know, we have legitimacy in doing this. And I guess that is proven.
He begins just starting to run with the ball and saying, this is how we roll.
Yeah, so he's captain of Geelong, comes back to Melbourne, first club, still continues to do it. And it's challenged in 1865 by Theodore Marshall of Royal Park at the time, where he instructs Jim Clark before the game, who is the second fastest man in the colony. And they've run races before that, but they know each other, Harrison and Clark. He says, if you get the ball and you need to run 100 yards or 80 or whatever it may be, you do it.
And this is at Richmond Paddock.
This is at Richmond Paddock, Royal Park, v Melbourne. He instructs his player to do it.
July 1865.
And he does it. And I guess in that moment kind of proves to Harrison that, okay, we might need to legislate this because, yeah, today it's me, tomorrow it's Clark, the next day it might be someone else. Then we just got people running.
So to talk that through, if Harrison's been running with the ball a bit, you know, maybe he's going six or seven steps where previously it was two or three, what actually happens on this day, July 1865, is that Marshall is instructed by Clark to get the ball and piss bolt as fast as he can without bouncing
the other way around. Marshall instructs
Marshall
Clark.
To piss bolt as fast as he can to the other end if you didn't get the piss bolt bit.
Yeah, yeah, piss bolt is my favourite Australian thing in the world.
Not to bounce and force Harrison to make a decision on running with the ball.
And that was his reason to do it.
If Harrison's just been taking a bit of license as a football man of the world, you know, I've played in Melbourne, I've played in Geelong, I've returned to Melbourne, I know how it works and I'm the captain, so just bloody well get on board. The counter-argument then becomes this incredibly quick guy running without bouncing and the rest of the opposition going, well, that's not on, is it? All of a sudden, the captains need to stop and make a decision. And effectively, what happens at this point is bouncing becomes a thing. Everyone's like, all right, we can see that running's okay, but if you're going to do that, you're going to have to bounce. You're going to have to make it fair on the rest of us.
I think also the origins of the activity as well, like the fact that people are slightly wary of where the sport could go. So they don't want the game to turn into something else. They don't want it to turn into what they've seen previously. Yes. They don't want it to become rugby or soccer even. So this idea that you can just run with it and you're lightning fast, you can go forever. Yeah, that sticks for a bit because you want your team to do well and you have a couple of beers and that's awesome. But for the most part, when it comes to everyone sitting down at the end of a season or for even after a game, well, we don't want our sport, which is brand new, turning into something else.
Yeah, to descend
into which they know what it is as well. You know, they're totally aware of what other activities are going on the other side of the pond, so to speak.
It's going to be nothing much more than tunnel ball if it's like that, you know. It's just a fast guy running on the outside of everybody else, and that's no fun. So to legislate against that, that's effectively where the origins of bouncing come from. But to contextualise that for people, in Yarra, what we now know as Yarra Park, that's where you park your car when you go to the MCG, that's chock full of rabbit warrens and trees, which means that running
that was
and bouncing
our fault as well. That was our fault as well.
Is a pain in the neck. Yeah, it's attributed to, you know, the Austin Hospital. It's that guy. It's Austin.
I've actually got a story about this. We're going to go off topic here for about 30 seconds.
You're clear. Take a bounce.
So I was...
very good.
Beautifully done. So the Austins are, I suppose, or the Austin family are blamed for introducing rabbits. Mm. There is a lot of conjecture around that. It's not necessarily true, actually, I don't think. And they do cop it big time. I was at an event not too long ago where there was an Austin there who was from the original Austins, and there was a bloke there who was a farmer who made a particular comment about this introduction of rabbits, and it did not go down well, I'll be honest with you. The young Austin gentleman,
probably from the Melbourne
shits,
Football Club.
It did not go down well. So I think the Austin introducing rabbits things, you know, a bit sketchy. Like a lot of the things we've brought up, you know, like there's some grey areas here. Which is why, you know, we want to hear from you guys and want to, you know, see what you guys think about some of the things we're bringing up. Finny, what's our Twitter handle?
It's at Origins of Footy.
I want to hear from you guys.
Absolutely.
Liam?
So it is the case that the game became an exciting game. It became an exciting game in the sense that not only could you then kick and mark, you could equally get the ball on the outside and move it quickly. If you could move it quickly, suddenly you can get the sense that the game, even if it's 40 aside, I mean, it says in the Geelong rules it's 25 aside to 30 aside, but even if you're playing it in a big open expanse with trees and all that, suddenly the game's broken open. You don't have to be tough and rugged and all that. You can be, I suppose, sort of a skinny, fast, and an outside
different
sort of player.
Different shapes as well. You know, guys can be different forms and have sort of different roles within, you know, what's going on.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And I presume I'm allowed to go ahead with the vivid description that comes, the backwards and forth one, or
did you? No, you go. No.
So this comes from Coventry's, but it's as good as we can see as a piece of commentary that it could have resulted, I suppose, in the early stages of the game. And it goes like this. Backwards and forwards. On this side, on that. Now out of bounds. Now in Dennis's cabbage garden. And again kicked into the branches of those horrible gums. Now kept in exciting closeness to the Melbourne goal. And then, with the fine spurt taken to the suburban headquarters, wavered the much-abused ball. And for 2 hours and a half, the closest observer couldn't tell which side had had any of the best of it. And ultimately, that's what becomes the game. That's what people turn out to see. They turn out to see an exciting game that's tough, fast, rugged, but not predictable. And part of their colony. It's part of their, I suppose, Saturday afternoon. And I like to think something that people chatted about as they left sort of, you know, Fitzroy and walked through what's now become the Fitzroy Gardens on their way to Yarra Park and talked about, geez, will he run it today? Do you reckon he'll bounce it properly? Will they stop the game and argue again? You know, that was a discussion, the kind of discussion that you talk about when you're on your way to the game going, geez, you reckon they're going to still play that out of bounds deliberately rule?
I think it's a beautiful paragraph there, just highlighting the fact that we describe this game as being so simplistic, but there's gums on the ground and we've got, you know, rabbit warrens hole, everywhere, yeah. And it's uphill, is it downhill? Mm. It's a massive ground. It's complex in a completely different way to the way that we see the modern game, really. I think that's just a fantastic description. I really do.
Yeah, and there's one last chance here left in this episode to talk about Mangrook. So Mangrook is touted as an indigenous game that I think people like to think was definitely part of the origins of the game, but there's no documented academic history. Wills lived in the west of Victoria, around the Grampian somewhere, Ararat Stall. Certainly at that time, there's equally documented evidence that a form of Mangrook occurred. Can you give a little overview of Mangrook without being, you know, too specific?
Yeah, look, I think firstly, yeah, I do totally appreciate the irony of someone with this accent taking this viewpoint, but I think there's more evidence that these activities were going on. However, linking it into what
Mangrook itself,
well, the origins of the game is slightly difficult. Mangrook itself is been quoted. There was a historian, Richard Thomas. It was described in a Robert Burrows Smythe book. Richard Thomas highlighted the fact that the foremost player will drop and kick the ball. It is made from the skin of a possum, and other players will leap in the air in order to catch it. And descriptions of seeing this in various places around the country. Obviously, this is not documented in the way that maybe the educated documented the origins of what we've been talking about, in a similar way to what happened in England, in that mob football was going on for a long period of time. Mm. It wasn't documented. There weren't the structures in place that we see from the public school system. And this is so difficult. Like the idea that you can say exactly where the origins of these things came from. Like we talked about this in episode one, Finney, and the fact that pretty much what all these guys are exposed to throughout their lives has an impact in the way that the AFL or the sport is developed. Whether or not Wills or any other of these guys were exposed to Mangrook, probably. And if they took parts of it out, probably that happened as well. Yeah. So it's really difficult to work that stuff out.
The real benefit of amateur radio is to be able to say that here's what we like to think. So I think what we like to think is that Wills saw an opportunity to not only put a good copy of a draft game that he'd seen previously, he also wanted to bring in little bits and pieces of stuff that he thought added a bit of sex appeal to the game. And
sexy football.
We like to think that even if he didn't want to legislate it in the first set of rules, that an Aboriginals game had influenced what he saw being the way that the game should be played, that he had seen it, that it was part of what made him what he was in what he saw the game being, and that he wanted to write some stuff down that he thought would be exciting. That isn't to suggest that in any way that Aboriginals saw a white man's game in the 1860s as being very exciting. Mm. It's not until much later that Aboriginals guys actually start playing games with white guys, but it is worth noting that Mangrook is something that we had considered, that we looked at for evidence, and sadly, white guys just didn't seem to be writing down big evidence around Mangrook at the time. But we want you listeners to know that every consideration was made by us to look into that at the time.
I think also there's probably stuff out there and people might have views on this. We want to hear about it.
And
I think it's a really fascinating part of this whole story and this like massive tapestry we're trying to paint, Finny.
Yeah, look, and certainly that kind of that... that push and pull between
good point, yeah.
The push and pull between, I mean, it was, I mean, our Indigenous players have always and did, we can assume back then, brought special skills to the game, but was our game modeled on those special skills is certainly, you know, completely up for conjecture, because as you said, that there is no written evidence of this stuff, and it is interesting to discuss.
Yes. So our podcast moving forward from this point go from this early changing strategic game where strategy and tactics in fact takes place to make the game open 360 degrees, more in the air and more individualized, to a place where infrastructure starts to take place around how the game is organised, clubs, and eventually, I suppose, the beginnings of the VFA. The VFA exists for many years as an organised and fixtured set of...
That's the important one, yeah, the fixtured. It had a ladder, there was a cup. There was a cup previously, which we'll talk about. But
people could rely on that for their entertainment of a weekend. And once that starts, the romance of it starts. And the particular thing that we'll come to in subsequent podcasts is the idea that it's the fans who can drive the game from that point forward. Fans can say, I like that, I don't like that. Of particular note is, you know, the high mark. You know, that's sexy. That defines our game unlike any other game. When people see someone, you know, Jeremy Howe, Tony Modra taking a big specky, that's exciting, and that makes our game one of its own. And that's effectively the fans who can do that. And it's still the fans today who drive rule changes, and they drive much of the entertainment value of the game. And that's where we're going to come to in our previous episodes. Our future episodes, I should say.
You're not painting a very good tapestry.
That's right. And as I take my pens and weave them into a tapestry that looks like Donald Trump's hair, I'd like to thank Finn O'Sullivan.
Thank you, gentlemen.
I'd like to thank Ryan Miller.
Cheers, gents.
And I'd like to thank myself. Thank you, Liam. And good evening.